This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Our contributor, Eliza Griswold, has been reporting from Pennsylvania on the political trends affecting the midterms. There's the Senate race between Mehmet Oz, Dr. Oz, and a Lieutenant Governor, John Fetterman, who suffered a stroke this year that's impacted his campaign, particularly after he struggled in a recent debate. But there's also something else going on in Pennsylvania, an energized movement of Christian nationalists aiming for power in state government. Those nationalists see God, not the will of voters, as the source of authority in government. Our writer Eliza Griswold says the movement is truly significant at the state level, where it can put far-right candidates into the legislature. Eliza, this is not your old-school Christian right that we used to talk about, the era of Billy Graham and Jerry Falwell, is it?
Not at all, David. This is something really different. This isn't about injecting, you know, Christian values into society. This is about overthrowing secular democracy.
In what sense?
In the sense that what we see is people who believe that a God-ordained government requires that they take over the institutions of democracy. It's actually a kind of thinking called dominionism that's growing very popular in some circles in Christianity.
So how is that influencing the races in Pennsylvania?
Well, let me take you back to an event that happened in early July.
Any free men and women in the house? Woo!
This took place in the rotunda of the State Capitol building, which is a beautiful building that nobody ever goes to, in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Wow, what a great day. Thank you.
And Doug Mastriano, who is the Republican candidate for governor, he was a headliner to this.
And what did he have to say? What were the ideas that he was espousing?
So this is a press conference that marked in Pennsylvania the Charter Day, which nominally it's a day that recognizes the anniversary of King Charles II granting William Penn the land, essentially, that is now Pennsylvania, which he did in 1681. Now, William Penn did that. He came to America because he needed religious freedom. And that's the idea, really, that Mastriano has seized on.
William Penn had a dream given to him by God of a place that we know later on as Pennsylvania, where men and women can live as they see fit and not as any king or magistrate or governor saw fit.
And as you Mastriano and many other members of the Christian nationalist movement use William Penn, the founder of Pennsylvania, as a kind of model and precursor for their imagined recapturing of history.
Having suffered so much for his faith and being castigated for being a Christian and condemned in the media and judged by those people who think they're so self-righteous and better than others that they can stand in judgment of others.
What Mastriano means is freedom for a tiny minority. He doesn't mean when he talks about persecution or persecution by the media or religious freedom, he isn't talking about diverse freedoms. He's talking about freedom for Christians like him.
No, Eliza, my understanding of the politics of the midterm elections revolves around inflation, around basic economic issues, around crime, around whether you like Joe Biden or not, or whether you think he's too old to be president, and all kinds of what you usually called kitchen table issues. This is something quite different. Is it really an animating part of the governor's race in Pennsylvania?
It is an animating factor because it fuels, in Pennsylvania, what's happened, as has happened elsewhere, is that it fuels the idea of basically stop the steal. The idea that God gave this Christian nation, it also gives people the obligation to overthrow what they say is illegitimate governments. And that's really how these two movements have fused between Christian nationalists who claim the moral authority of God and election deniers who are looking for a base who will support them in their claims that 2020 was fraudulent and we have to massively change voting for the future.
Another person who spoke at that event along those lines is a woman named Abby Abildness. Can you tell us who she is?
So Abby Abildness calls herself an apostle in this movement to literally capture state legislatures and bring America back to an imagined past when it was a Christian nation. She has risen to prominence as a leader of these Jericho marches, which really sprang up in the wake and got powerful in the wake of the 2020 election, and in many ways became a precursor to what we saw on January 6th.
Okay, we're in the middle of the Jericho March going around. We just did the first two times around.
And the idea at the core of them is that the state capital, the secular government, the seat of secular government, is evil as the city of Jericho was in the Bible. And these guys are calling on God to knock down the seat of secular government so that they can, inspired by God, come in and take it over by walking seven times around the Capitol.
March around seven times, and you will see me bring it down. God will bring it down. This is a big call on our whole nation, but Pennsylvania really is leading from our founders.
Abby Abildness really brings together a lot of these different elements, right? Because on one hand, she is, you know, an apostle in this movement we've been talking about. On the other, she helps lead the Biblical Prayer Caucus in Pennsylvania. These prayer caucuses are across the country. They are the way that over the past decade, we have seen the far right take over state legislatures by infusing these different kinds of biblical bills, like, well, gay people can't adopt children, right? Constitutional bans on abortion. That's really associated with this group. And it's growing and it's powerful. And it is a way that the old school Christian right has become something very new and far more muscular.
You know, we hear the term Christian nationalist all the time. And as someone who's been reporting on this movement, tell me what the term means to you. And also, how many people identify truly as Christian nationalists in this country?
So what the term means, anybody, most of the people who espouse to these ideas, most of the people who believe in these ideas don't like that term at all. They reject it as like a liberal construct. Mastriano asked me, is this a term you fabricated? So how it's different from the old school Christian right is this idea that Christians, of course, America's a Christian nation. Now, that's something, according to a recent study, 45% of Americans believe, which is alarming enough, right? But then you take that idea, it's not just that America is a Christian nation. Christians are duty-bound to take over the instruments of government and society, and that really is different. Now, how popular is it? That's a harder question to answer. The truth is, a lot of this is rooted in Pentecostalism, speaking in tongues. This is the fastest-growing religion in the world. Right? It's highly decentralized. It doesn't have numbers attached. And people claim their own authority, right? These people are prophets and apostles who say that God has told them to do certain things. And that is really new. And that is pretty concerning.
I can't help asking, the decisive race in these midterm elections may be the Senate race in the state of Pennsylvania. Some months ago, we would have thought that Mehmet Oz just didn't have a chance. I mean, he was being described quite roundly in Pennsylvania as somebody who doesn't live in the state, as someone who is improvising all the time in terms of policy in the worst possible sense, and just somebody destined to lose, Fetterman. But then things changed. He had a stroke, and the recovery process has been very complicated. And that culminated in what I have to think was a problematic at best and possibly disastrous debate with Oz. So where is that race now?
Good question. So that race is too close to call and will be for some time. John Fetterman, who is 6'8", right, like in shorts, in snow, like he's a burly Democrat, right? Which we may see as the future of the party. Like maybe that's helpful when we talk about like left populism, right? There is something very human about his hesitations now, which I myself experienced with him when I interviewed him, which we had to do with closed captioning, right? Like he couldn't do that in person. And we make all kinds of allowances for people. So just to say that. But at the same time, the people who he's going for, the disaffected white working class who went for Trump and peeling them off the Republican Party, which is one of the places he's been so successful, these are not a lot of guys who are looking for empathy and talk about ableism, you know? So the question is, can he hold them if he doesn't look competent?
Mm-hmm. What has been the course of the numbers in the last couple of months?
The margin has just gone down and down, right? He was leading with a super comfortable margin. Oz exactly looked like a joke, especially. And Fetterman was so good with that. Like, you would drive around, you'd see signs. On lawns, you'd see signs for Fetterman and Mastriano, right? Those days are behind us. And it's hard to know, is that because of his health? Is that because races always tighten, right? It's unclear. And Republicans, I've talked to several this week who are actually gleeful, you know, and also feel generous enough to say, well, I hope the guy's okay. But you can see that they think they scored a major point, and we'll have to see how that plays out.
Eliza, thank you so much.
David, thank you.
You can read Eliza Griswold's reporting on the Pennsylvania election campaign and much more at NewYorker.com. In a moment, we'll look more deeply at Christian nationalism with the theologian Russell Moore. That's all ahead today on the New Yorker Radio Hour. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Russell Moore is a leading thinker in the evangelical Christian movement. And until recently, he held a key position in the Southern Baptist Convention. But Reverend Moore left the SBC last year after taking a firm stance opposing racism in the church and criticizing its response to sexual abuse allegations. Now, although he's not a progressive or a liberal in our understanding, Moore has repeatedly denounced the politics of Christian nationalism, which we were speaking about earlier in this program. In one of his recent editorials, he referred to Christian nationalism as liberation theology for white people. Russell Moore is the editor of Christianity Today. Now, I'd like to really begin by asking you about the church that you grew up in Mississippi, Wilmarket Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that church that you were raised in.
Well, that church was the center of my identity because I was there all the time. It was the rhythm of the week. It was the rhythm of the year. And it was a really strong community. And I was able to see the best of what Christian community actually can be, along with some of the darker things that I saw as well. And part of that was I had a grandmother who was the widow of my grandfather, who had been pastor of the church before I was born. And she would make sure that I was there constantly, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. But we would never go on the first Wednesday of every month, which was congregational business meeting. And I just assumed you just didn't go to that. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I was grown that I said, well, why did we never go for a business meeting? And she said, well, I didn't want you to see that. I wanted you to be a Christian. So she protected me from some of the wilder aspects.
You mentioned the darker side of things. What do you mean?
Well, I had a spiritual crisis as a 15-year-old, not because of my church, but because of the Bible Belt generally. Looking around and seeing some high-profile TV evangelist scandals that were going on, it was more this sense of seeing the way that religion could be used in order to fleece people. Along with persistent racism, I couldn't understand how Bible Belt Christianity couldn't recognize something that is very explicit throughout the New Testament, and then to see the way that politics was using the religion. And so I started to wonder, is this all just a means to an end? Is this all just politics or racism or whatever, some form of social control? And then you add to it, of course, there was a great deal of Bible prophecy speculation at the time. For instance, we're right on the brink of the second coming, which is similar in many ways to the things that we're seeing now with QAnon and other conspiracy theories. They're really a secularized version of the worst forms of that.
Why did you pursue a life in the church rather than go in another direction?
Well, because I became convinced that Jesus of Nazareth did, in fact, was in fact raised from the dead, and did establish a church. And the other thing is, being as familiar with the Bible as I was, it was hard to. It was hard to have the kind of idealized picture of the church that could lead to existential disappointment. I mean, so the New Testament.
Did you know that you were? It's a tough bargain. In other words, it seems that you knew that you were headed for a life of opposition and difficulty.
I don't know that I knew that. I think my father knew that. My father was a pastor's kid. And when I told him later on that I thought I was being called into ministry, he was not happy. And he said, I'll support you. I'll never bring it up again. And he didn't. But he said, but I wish you wouldn't do it.
Because he thought what was going to happen?
Because he had seen his own father, I mean, growing up in a parsonage right next door to a church, he had seen the sorts of backroom politics and those sorts of things up close, and he didn't want to see that happen to me.
So evangelical Christians, as we know, have been active in politics for a long time. How have things changed since the era you grew up in with Jerry Falwell Sr. and Pat Robertson, the Moral Majority, and so on? How have things shifted to where we are today?
Well, in one sense, if you just think about the language of moral majority, there was a sense in the 1980s and the 1990s that that evangelical Christianity, if not theologically, then certainly morally, really represented the country. So things that were going on in the country that were seen to be moral decline, were being imposed on the country. That's not where most people were. And so the way that you countered that was by mobilizing regular Americans, real Americans. I think what's happened since then is right now there's a kind of contradictory set of impulses that will retain some of that. We are the real America and elites are the problem. Those who are in power culturally, politically in the country. And this sense of being a beleaguered minority. So there's an existential threat coming. So you put both of those things together. One is the real America, that the nation's a Christian nation. Most people are people who agree with you. And yet you're attacked and marginalized. That then becomes this sense of it's a unique form of threat that's experienced by some.
You wrote something very interesting. Before you left the Southern Baptist Convention, you wrote an internal memo, which was eventually leaked. You referred to what you called the perennial temptation toward political captivity of the gospel.
Yeah.
What were you thinking? What does that mean?
Well, I think that there are always going to be opportunists or strongmen who are going to want to take religion and use it to make whatever position they have seem transcendent. I think that's as old as Pharaoh with the Egyptian gods. It's what we see now with European blood and soil ethno-nationalist movements wanting to use Christianity, which what they mean by Christianity is being French or being German or being Dutch, not being whatever the outsider is deemed to be. And you see it in the United States of America.
We hear a lot about Christian nationalism now. In your view, what is Christian nationalism, and does it bear any resemblance to what we used to call evangelical politics in, you know, in the period that you were growing up in the 80s and 90s?
No, this is a different thing, and that's kind of one of the problems with there are secular people who have really see every engagement by evangelical Christians in the civic arena as being theocracy and so mm-hmm. forth. And so they're often not able to tell the difference between that and genuine theocracy or genuine Christian nationalism. And what Christian nationalism is, in my view, is the use of Christian doctrines or symbols for the maintenance of an ethnic or a national identity. And
it's anti-democratic by nature, isn't it?
It's anti-democratic by nature, yes.
And racism, I'm afraid, seems to be a deep component of this. You've been very clear in your view that racism is a sin. It violates your faith, and you feel a duty to fight it. But many in the Southern Baptist Convention and at many other churches apparently don't share your view. Tell me about that.
There are very few people who will say, I'm for racism, I'm against racial harmony. But they're defining it not just personally, they're defining it emotively. And so I'm not for people actively hating each other because of the color of their skin. When you start talking about, though, the actual implications of that, then that becomes often labeled as Marxism or critical race theory mm-hmm. or something along those lines. So there are many of us who would be facing often charges of critical race theory who are as far away from any sort of critical theory as possible. That sin and injustice, it's not just a problem for the people it hurts. It also is a problem mm-hmm. for the people who are captive to it. And so standing against racism is, in my view, not only good for the people racists oppress, but for the racists themselves. This is no way to live.
This year, an independent investigation of sexual abuse in the church outlined how leadership refused to address very extensive allegations of sexual abuse. How has this affected Southern Baptist churches?
I think there were some of us, and I would be one of them, surprised by how that played out, because I would have predicted that there would be some apathy, and the kind of apathy I typically would find would be from people who would say, well, that's a horrible thing, but it doesn't happen with us. And that's something that happens in the Roman Catholic Church mm-hmm. or somewhere else, but it can't happen with us. Or even the people who would say, well, it could happen somewhere, but it couldn't happen in my church because we know each other and we trust each other. And when the independent third party report came out, and I was expecting, you know, having dealt with this for so long and been stonewalled and everything else with this, I expected that I would be the least surprised person in the world by what the report detailed. And I was mouth open shocked by how bad it was.
Now, Reverend, you've written about how men and women have different roles, different responsibilities in society. And that belief is known as complementarianism. Do you think that these traditional gender roles may have enabled some of the predatory behavior by men in power in the church?
I think so. The scripture speaks of men and women mostly in terms of how we are the same as human beings. There are references to our differences, but when there's an exaggeration of the distinction, then that can be used in all sorts of twisted ways, and I think that was the case. Simply because of how few women were in the room where decisions were being made.
So it's a systemic problem, that sexual abuse kind of grows out of a systemic problem, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's not just the failing of some targeted individuals.
Not just a failing of some individuals. It comes with both this sense of the less than status of women or of the vulnerable, and then you add to it institutional self-protection, and that then becomes a system that's very, very difficult to overcome.
Forgive me, but in your case, it makes me wonder why you don't, considering what you've been saying, drift toward a more, for want of a better word, liberal church.
Because I'm not a liberal. I actually believe what the Bible teaches. I actually believe the historic Christian faith. I was on a campus, a very secular campus, last year, and an atheist student was asking me theological questions. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it said, "So wait a minute, you're a real deal Bible thumping hellfire and brimstone sort of fundamentalist." And I said, "Yes, I feel very seen right now. That's exactly what I am."
Well, an enormous weight today is put by conservatives on culture war issues, gay marriage, medical treatment for trans kids, all kinds of things. And it's said that these are symptoms of a vast moral crisis brought on by the left. You agree with that?
Well, I think that there are things that are symptoms of a moral crisis. I'm not sure that they're brought on only by the left. I think that moral depravity is not sorted by a political constituency, but is present in every person and all people. So I'm not sure how to assign blame for that. I do think there are things that are moral crises, and I do think that there are ways that Christians and others need to be speaking into those things. But I think that often what happens is that there is a reordering of priorities where the theology becomes the second step from the politics rather than the politics being an implication of the theology. And that's where I think things become very dangerous. And Christianity becomes the tool that you use to get to them, then it becomes something other than Christianity.
Reverend Moore, I can't help but ask, when you go speak on a secular campus, mm-hmm. or when you talk with public radio, or secular press, or the New Yorker magazine, or what have you, mm-hmm. do you feel like as if you are being, as you said, seen before, heard properly, understood?
I do think that there's a segment of secular America that doesn't understand what it is to be motivated religiously, and who then thinks merely in cultural political terms. I told a journalist one time, "You seem to think that evangelicals are just like cicadas that go into dormancy between Iowa caucuses." And it's much more complicated than that. And I think it's sometimes hard for some secular people to see that. And I think it's also hard for some of my own religious people to see how they can secularize in ways that aren't NPR, mimosa drinking, Sunday brunches, but can be a very secularized form of Christian nationalism. And you have to come in and say, you've actually secularized.
How would Jesus Christ, in your view, have reacted to American Christian nationalism?
I think it would be very dangerous to put words in Jesus's mouth there without actually becoming what I'm trying to oppose here. What I would say is, you have Jesus who was who always refused to have his gospel used as a means to an end, because he had a much bigger. A bigger view of what's important and what the gospel actually is. And so people who settle for Christianity or any other religion as politics are really making a pitiful deal and settling for far too little.
Reverend Moore, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Moore is the editor of Christianity Today. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The first season of HBO's White Lotus chronicled the visit to a Hawaiian resort of a select group of the very, very privileged, a tech mogul and her family, a pair of newlyweds having second thoughts, and an heiress who's grieving and in need of therapy.
When I saw my mother's ashes hit the water, you know, I just reminded me of, you know, sprinkling fish food in an aquarium. And I was just like, oh my God, you know, am I feeding my mother to the fishes?
All the while, the resort's manager is having a complete meltdown that's both hilarious and kind of harrowing to watch. New Yorker staff writer Nomi Fry called the show a near-note-perfect tragicomedy.
When I first watched the first season of White Lotus, I was really interested in its combination of scathing critique and kind of just basic plot enjoyment, right? So it was about watching a bunch of rich people in a luxury resort supposed to be having the time of their lives, and through a series of events, having like the worst time of their life, pretty much. But it also said something bigger about where we are right now as a society. And I think it's fairly rare that a show manages to do both of these things without being too ponderous or too flimsy. I think one of the things that interested me to talk about with Mike White, he's a very successful writer and creator. He wrote movies like School of Rock. He's a very well-respected and successful screenwriter and producer. But another funny and interesting thing about him that maybe some people don't know is that he's also a huge fan of reality competition shows and has even participated in a couple of those shows himself. He was on Survivor on the David versus Goliath season a few years ago. And he was also on The Amazing Grace, where he partnered up with his father. And the issues that come up in those reality shows that have to do with status, competition, power relationships between people are also, I think, evident in White Lotus and what he does in White Lotus.
Season 2 of the show has just premiered, set this time in Sicily. Nomi Fry sat down with the creator, Mike White.
Was it your hope from the get-go that this would be part of a kind of series? Like, okay, each season will concentrate on another location and the connecting thread would be that these are all part of this, like, franchise, you know, hotel franchise.
I mean,
basically.
You know, to be honest, the first one was just such a one-off flyer, you know, like there was no big design to what would be, you know, what would follow. In my mind, you know, I'd always tried to figure out how to do this. Like, I was on The Amazing Race, and it was like, when I was on The Amazing Race, I was like, how can I...
With your father, right?
Exactly.
Your father was your partner.
And so I was always like, this is so cool. I would love to be able to simulate this in my own, you know, wheelhouse of, like, yeah, scripted stuff and figure out how to travel and go new places and have, you know, a kind of life adventure while I was still trying to make something, you know, artistic. Like, I had this idea for a honeymoon show, which was, like, basically me getting to have this Amazing Race experience where, you know, it's like a couple on an ambitious honeymoon and you follow them and one of them realizes that, you know, they know the person in a way that they didn't know prior to traveling.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but then in the back of my mind, I was like, well, maybe we could do this again, new characters. So, like, the misbehaving actors from the first season that I don't want to bring back, I can just... dump. Not that there were any, but like, it's just that idea, like, I can start fresh. I'm not somebody who, like, is really that interested in, you know, keeping a franchise going creatively.
Right.
Sometimes it just feels like I don't want to, like, because after a while that just feels like a job.
Yes.
So, like, it's like I don't want a job. So this felt like great. Like, I can bring in new people, tell a new story, go somewhere new. And I mean, to me, that's like cracking the code for just my own personal, like, druthers.
Because you like to travel?
Well, it's just, I mean, like, thing? Yeah, like the experience we had in Sicily, just like, I mean, like that's, I mean, I could start crying. Like, it's just like, just to be able to, yeah, like, I mean, this, that's the life I always, you know, always wanted as like a, whatever, a middle class kid growing up in like a homogenous Pasadena. It was just like, go and shoot in Asia, go shoot in, you know, Europe. Yeah. You're like, get out of like my little, yeah. And now I'm spoiled. So it's like, I think it's like, unless it's like firing on all of these like lifestyle pistons, it's just, it's not enough. Or just like, forget it. So yeah, I never want to like drive on the 405 to like a stage in Burbank again.
Right.
I sound like such a douche.
That's interesting because in a way that kind of parallels the experiences of some, at least some of the people who are, you know, some of the characters on the show, right?
Yeah.
The idea of being able to leave your life behind and go and, you know, become this new thing is something that the show is kind of about in a way, right? Like this, does that
yeah,
idea
interest
you? And
I also think that like traveling, especially vacationing, it's very ripe with just existential, the existential experience, which is like, who am I? What do I want? Like, what do I want? And like in a vacation too, it's like you're seeking pleasure. You're seeking some kind of, I don't know. It sounds, I always feel stupid talking about, but like I do like existential like comedies or what. It's like that people who mm-hmm. are like searching for meaning in their life and like how, what is the life I want to live? How do I, and not so much situational stuff. So I just felt like, I was like, this definitely feels like it's of a piece of the kinds of things I like to get into in, you know, when I write.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Did you write, I know that you wrote the first season on your own, which is not completely typical, I think, right? Is this, did the second season, did you write it on your own? Did you have a writer's room or?
No, I used to have a writer's room when I first started making shows. I only made 4 shows, but the first 2 had writer's rooms.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
I found it to be very, you know, the writers would write their scripts and I would look at it and I'd be like, this isn't written by by me. Like, I just, it was like, it wasn't alive unless I was immersed in it somehow. It's the part of the job that I, you know, is, I don't want to subcontract it out. You know, it's like, I don't really, yeah, it's just like, I don't see myself as a producer. I look at myself as a writer who is finding different ways to do it. And so, mm-hmm. yeah. So I, for me, it was like, over time, I realized like, yeah, it may limit the show's point of view. It may, you know, there's criticism that comes, I guess, especially lately, of someone being the sole like kind of creator. If I wasn't able to do that, I would just go write something, and I'd go write a book, or I'd find some other medium, because I just don't really, I don't want to like interpret someone else's writing, you know what I mean?
Right.
That's not what I'm about.
Right. Although that's interesting because I know you to also be a very successful writer for hire, right? On other people's projects.
Yeah, which is the writing part. But like,
sure.
I've never really directed somebody else's work or, I mean, I've produced, yeah. but I hated it. So like, it's just like, I like kind of being helpful in those situations. Plus it's nice to get paid.
So let's talk a little bit about this season. It seems that the focus, the thematic focus, it's more about kind of sexual politics and the ways people interact with each other and have conflict with each other and have conflict resolution with each other and so on, is through the sexual realm.
Yes. The first season, you know, was a lot about money and how it impacts all relationships. And because we shot in Hawaii, it did, you know, obviously get into colonialism and like, you know, different kind of macro elements of that same idea. And I was worried about like trafficking in that again, because I was like, I'm just gonna get dragged. Like, I was already like, it was just like, I felt like we got through the first season just like by the,
yes.
the skin
yes.
of our teeth. Like, just because it
yes.
was just like, you know, I don't know, like, yeah, just the, I mean, and there were like, you know, fierce criticisms from certain people about me as a creator touching on these topics and as a white
man and so on.
Yeah, exactly. And so I didn't know if I had the stomach to go through that again. And I also felt like I think we need a new theme in general. You know, I had a different idea, you know, but then when we got to Sicily, there were all these Testa di Mora heads. And like, mm-hmm. and the Testa di Mora is about sexual jealousy and mm-hmm. adultery. And I just was like, well, maybe that's where we start this. You know, that there's still this unfettered machismo that you kind of associate with Sicily and like this kind of, you know, this like old world way of dealing with, you know, like issues and like this kind of like patriarchal, like street, mm-hmm. you know, way of handling conflict. And like, and so
it's
just like,
it's less woke than a quote unquote than America.
Certainly
in the imagination.
Yeah. And also it's just like, yeah, for some it's like a nightmare. And for some it's like a sort of bucolic fantasy of how like men could be, still be men. And, you know,
sure.
And so it just felt like, I was like, well, this is kind of funny to have. And then I had this idea of like, yeah, three generations of like American men, you know, in different stages of their relationship to being a man. So yeah, I kind of pivoted to that theme.
It just seems like the body would naturally stop getting horny once you're past the age of procreation, you know? Like at 50, you would just stop.
50? 50's not that old.
It just seems undignified.
I'm still virile, by the way. I could still impregnate a woman.
Oh. No girl should have to be exposed to an old guy's junk.
It's not like it was ever so beautiful to look at anyway. I mean, it's a penis. It's not a sunset.
The thing that always interests me about sex, and I think is what saturates the show, is this kind of the animal in us, the monkey in the man, you know, and how as much as we want to be virtuous or dignified or, you know, upstanding individuals, there's this antic force in us that, like, you know, motivates us and pulls the rug out from under us. And I, without sounding Freudian, I just think that imbues life, you know, in every, you know, actors talk about what's my motivation? And it's like the motivation of sex is always like primary, I think.
Right. I mean, there's nothing more interesting than sex and money, I think.
It turns out that's true.
But, you know, speaking of money, and I know you've spoken about this a little bit, about what it's like, you know, being interested in writing, you know, and making a show about people, about status, right? About status, money, power. So dealing with that, but also being at a point in your life in which you yourself are, you know, quite powerful. And our listeners, you know, can't see. I can see Mike on the Zoom, and his eyes are opening wide, and his smile is, you know, explosive, absolutely explosive. But no, but I just mean, you can admit that you're coming to writing about this like knot of issues, not from the place of like, you know, a kind of aspirant, but as a person who in some ways has arrived, or maybe one never arrives, you know, maybe that's another thing.
I know. I mean, it's definitely why, you know, sometimes criticism is lobbed just as a person going through the world and being seen in a certain way. My observations or what I'm creating is suspect because, yeah, I have money and I haven't given it all away. I have, you know, I'm not walking with the poor. Like my dad always told me that, you know, we were supposed to, if we, you know, like my dad was a minister and was like, you know, he didn't believe rich people should even own houses, you know, and I grew up in a rich community, but we were not rich. And so like, I always was fascinated and kind of repelled by the rich people.
Yeah.
Like, I guess I will always see myself as someone from the outside looking in, whether I'm not that or not. I think it holds true to just my writing in general, which is like, I like to see, put out the like, the flawed human characters, you know, like, and not try to create idealistic, flattering characterizations of people, but at the same time see that they are human, you know, like, or whatever. I don't know how to do it any other way. So like, it's like, either just don't come to my class or like,
yeah.
Whatever.
No, I know. I mean, I think it's honest. I mean, there's a thing I often say to my husband, which is like, the first step is to admit that you're part of the problem.
And the problem is as old as time itself. You know, it's like, it's not like, yeah. this is like a historical reality that like, I will never be pure. You know, it reminds me of like Survivor, which was like, I went on Survivor and like, you see yourself as the underdog of the story. And everyone does. Like, it doesn't matter. Elon Musk, I'm sure, feels like he's the underdog of the story. Like, he's coming in and he's changing the system and like, he's, you know, finding all these obstacles and like, he's going to come in and he's going to be the fighter. And then it's like, so it's like, and everyone feels that way. So I feel that way. I feel like I'm like this weirdo kid who like never like fit in. I was like this weird writer. Like, and it's like, and then I get on Survivor. Survivor, which I've always been like, oh, that'd be so cool to play. And I've always identified with the underdog. I've always fought, you know, wanted the underdog to win. I just naturally associate with the underdog and gravitate to those stories. And then you get on there and they're like, oh, you're a Goliath. And I was like, I'm the Goliath? What? And then you're like, oh, yeah, I am the Goliath. And not only am I a Goliath, but I am the heel. I'm the villain in this story. Like, there's like, I look across and I see all of these, you know, Davids. And I'm like, oh, this is a story about them overcoming me. And I'm the bad guy. And it's like, and I see that writ large in my own career, which is like, you know, it was always this like, you know, whatever, like this outsider who was determined to write stories that did not, like, you know, we're not about the beautiful people. We're not about like the, well, it wasn't about sex and da, da, da. It's like, and here I am. And like the biggest success of my career is about writing about like, hot
beautiful people
on vacation.
Fucking in paradise.
And it's just like, there's a part of me, the 22-year-old in me is like, what have I done? At the same time, it's just like, well, this is just this natural, this is the natural like stage of life. Like, I don't know. I'm just going through this. And it's like, yeah, you can reject me, you know, go ahead. Like, whatever.
Never.
You know, I just feel like I'm being true to what I'm seeing around me. I hope that I'm not writing this show for the rest of my career or that I can, you know, expand beyond whatever the ideas of this show. But it does feel like it's like, if you're taking a snapshot, you know, I am being true to like the things that I'm thinking about right now.
Mike White speaking with staff writer Nomi Fry. Season 2 of White Lotus premiered last week. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. One last thing before we go. The actor Jennifer Lewis was on the show recently, and she had some very good advice that we should all remember this week.
I don't care who you are or where you work. Get your ass out and vote. This ain't the election to sit home and lurk. Get your ass out and vote. Get your ass.
Do what the lady says, okay? This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Toon Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele.
Along with Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, Jenny Lawton, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline, Meher Bhatia, and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.